This is LI in the AM with Jay Oliver. News, traffic, weather, and more. 1039 LI News Radio.
Well, a big day as far as the national ramifications. And indeed, a partial government shutdown round two at stake. Dr. David Birdsell, Mark Steen of the Austin W. Marks School of Public and International Affairs, talking about the great Baruch College. And it's always great to have him on. David, how are you, sir? Welcome aboard.
Doing well, thank you. Great to be here.
You know, if everything goes according to plan today, David, I guess the bipartisan border security and spending package bill, that'll be voted on by the House and Senate, and then be on the president's desk, I guess, I would guess, by this evening. Trump says he's going to sign it, avert the shutdown. But you know something? He has changed his mind at the last minute in the past couple of situations, right? So, you know, nothing is really certain until he actually, I guess, puts pen to paper here.
I think that's absolutely right. He has shown a tendency to change his mind, particularly after listening to the champions of his base. And I'm talking about right-wing media figures, people like Sean Hannity. And Sean Hannity has already weighed in strongly against this compromise. But the president has very few cards to play if he turns off the television set and looks toward his support in the GOP-led Senate. There, the senators very much want to avoid another shutdown. They know the pain that it causes in practical terms. They know the political damage that it inflicts on the Republican Party disproportionately, because more people hold the Republicans and the president responsible for the shutdown than they do Democrats. That, of course, walks back to the president's December promise to own and be proud about shutting down the government. So I think another shutdown is very unlikely. I think the president's very likely to sign this. But as you say, it ain't over till it's over, and we'll see tonight or sometime tomorrow.
Hey, listen, I wish Sean Hannity would shut up. I mean, listen, the Dems gave him 1.6. Let's not forget that. Actually, more money last time, David, than the 1375 on the table now. Let's not forget that.
That's absolutely right. This deal keeps on getting worse for the president in some respect, although, of course, there is a lot of border security money in there, just not going toward a wall per se. The administration is quite rightly trumpeting a larger gross amount. It's just a smaller net amount that goes to the wall. So absolutely less wall, more time. And if this were to go into a third round, the prospects for the electoral prospects for Republicans and for the president's reputation would be very, very uncertain.
Take the money and run. Take the 1.4 and run. You cannot have, under any circumstances on this planet, what we saw round one. The 35 days, the soup kitchen lines, the pantries, the feeding tubes with the babies, what to do, lose electricity. What do you do? You can't have these stories come out in it. You can't have it. You can't put these people as hostages in order to get this done. Somehow, some way, you know, you have to find the heart in all of this. I don't want to hear from the Hannitys of this world. Take the money and run, I say.
Absolutely. And, you know, you're entirely right. The human cost is extraordinary for the 800,000 federal workers. And we have to remember an even larger amount of contract workers who are affected. Worse in the case of the contract workers, because they aren't able to claw back the pay. And the president has been very clear. This was originally introduced into the compromise bill that they be repaid. But they're not going to be, and that was pulled out of the bill. So lots of human costs, but it's also what these people do. They maintain air traffic safety. They make sure that folks with bad intentions don't get on airplanes. They make sure that we have safe and accessible parks. They make sure that our highways are safe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's not only the cost to their pocketbooks, which is bad enough, it's the cost to us as a nation if they aren't doing what we pay them to do.
No question, Dr. David Birdsell with us, Baruch. Let's shift gears. Let's hope he signs it and move on here and build upon the 1.4. You know, listen, I think everybody is in agreement in summation here, David, that there is border security that's needed here. We all know it. Let's face it, the gang stuff keeps going on. The drugs are coming in. The murders are being committed. Illegal aliens are pretty much at the helm. In some of these cases, tough to take. The Nevada couple, Rings Lodge, the 80-year-old couple killed by an illegal alien. It keeps going and going. Listen, we got to fix the system. It's broken. We have to fix it. Somehow, some way, we've got to fix this.
I couldn't agree more. What we desperately need, and we've needed for almost two full decades now, is comprehensive immigration reform that recognizes a couple of things. First, exactly as you say, we need to be able to control our borders. We need to know whom we're letting into the country, and reduce, if not completely eliminate, I think it's a practical impossibility to completely eliminate, but reduce as far as possible the number of people we don't want to cross the border who are crossing our border. But we also need to acknowledge this country's flat requirement for not only stable, but increased legal immigration. We have a declining birth rate. We would have, without immigration, a shrinking population, and that would be terrible for the economy. Just take a look at Japan. Take a look at Italy. We know that immigration is a part of this nation's economic success as well as part of its story, its legend, its identity since we became a nation. So we've got to figure out how to make this work. I couldn't agree more, and comprehensive immigration reform is the way to think about it.
Biggest things, and I've stated this time after time, is this Unaccompanied Minors Act. I mean, if we don't cement this, we're going to have the same problems. You know, these guys are coming into this country, being thrown out and let back in. You know, court dates, they never show up. We have to firm up this Unaccompanied Minors Act. This has been bandied about forever. It's like the gun stuff with the bump stocks. Back and forth, Parkland happens, back and forth, nothing gets done. This one has to be solidified. Has to be.
And we can address that in the context of a comprehensive reform package. That's very similar to, but in a much broader scale, the kind of budget agreement that we're seeing moving through the Congress this week, that nobody's 100% satisfied, but nobody is 100% dissatisfied either. That's the legislative process. You make compromises in order to get what you need. You declare the inviolables. You listen to the other side's inviolables. And you figure out what you can all live with in the service of the nation. And that's what we need to do with regard to immigration. And remember, the political battlefield is littered with the corpses of people who have tried. George W. Bush tried to make this happen. Barack Obama never prioritized it, but he talked about it. There have been champions in the Senate, from Lindsey Graham to John McCain to Ted Kennedy, a whole host of people, Democrats, Republicans, others, have championed immigration reform of some sort. They haven't gotten traction because people have kowtowed to the more extreme elements of their parties. We can get past that. We got through with a budget resolution. Remember, these are appropriation resolutions, not continuing resolutions. Let's try to make it happen with one of the important defining features of who we are as a nation, immigration policy.
Bottom line is Zeldin, King, Swazi, Rice, they need to step up. That's why we elected them and reelected some of these folks. This is where they come into play and earn their bucks, as far as I'm concerned. Have to step up, have to make this come true, because it's where they reside over these districts here on the island. That's where we have the problems. We have a huge MS-13 gang problem, and it continues to rear its ugly head. Even though, you know, I got to hear from the district attorney in Suffolk County stating the fact that they are on the run. Can't say that either. So hopefully something good will come about. Let's shift gears a little bit here, David. Let's go to this Paul Manafort stuff. You know, I tell you, just when you think this guy can't fall anymore, he has. This federal judge saying he intentionally, as he put it, his word, lied to special counsel Robert Mueller's office, the FBI, and a grand jury. So the judge basically pulling Manafort's plea deal. And what that means, ladies and gentlemen, is the special counsel does not have to lobby for a reduced sentence for him, as he agreed to. Remember that. He agreed to. So
right.
It's going to be
right.
A very interesting dynamic here regarding this now.
Well, that's right. And Mr. Manafort has proven capable time and again of deciding that lies are the better way to travel than simply telling people the truth. And what he lied about here, and his attorneys represented that he simply had slips of memory, that he couldn't exactly recall the details of conversations. And he's meeting with his longtime business partner and his longtime representative in Ukraine and Russia in a cigar bar slash restaurant in New York with a panoramic view of the city, set up very carefully. It's a high-profile, prominent meeting and the first face-to-face between Mr. Kilimnik and Mr. Manafort in quite a long while. And he can't remember anything about it after prompting in a courtroom. Beggars the imagination to even think that that could possibly be true. That's what the judge found yesterday as well. And Paul Manafort just continues to dig himself a grave with lie after lie.
He faces a couple of sentencings. I believe the first is the second week in March. And one of the things the judge said Manafort lied about was his, of course, his interactions, I guess, with a Russian associate during and after the campaign. It really kind of brings up a question asked repeatedly all during the probe, David, is why have so many of Trump's associates been caught lying? I mean, it was one after the other after the other. It's just unbelievable. Lying about their contacts with Russians. I mean, it just keeps going here.
Well, it does. And, of course, we don't know exactly why they've lied. But the pattern is indisputable, and it now numbers more than 100 Trump aides and associates who have lied very specifically about their contact with various Russian entities and actors over the course of the campaign period and into the post-election period, and some into the sitting administration. So there's lots and lots of smoke. The question is, where's the fire and how big is it and what is it all about? This question that we're looking at with Paul Manafort right now is meetings with a gentleman named Konstantin Kilimnik, who had been his fixer in Ukraine, his conduit to big Russian money, notably Oleg Deripaska, one of the Russian oligarchs, to whom Paul Manafort owed $10 million. Now, why, we might ask, would Paul Manafort, as an unpaid campaign chairman during the midst of the campaign, the general election now, meet with a conduit to a Russian oligarch to whom he owed $10 million. As the special counsel's attorney perhaps unwittingly disclosed in subsequently released trial transcripts, that question goes to the heart of the special counsel's inquiry, and you can see why.
It's I just get a kick out of it because Manafort's lawyers, you know, they're saying, listen, he didn't intentionally lie, but, you know, he did. So, I mean, which way is it? You know, I mean, it's just unreal. The back and forth you hear on this constant prevarications involved.
I think it bears repeating that this is also a guy who pledged to the special counsel not to lie anymore. I mean, the deal at that stage was, yes, I lied about a few things. I'm going to cut a deal with you. You're going to argue for leniency for me, and I'm never going to lie to you again. And then he proceeds to lie, 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 lie. And that's what the court's taking him up on. It's not even the first round of lies. It's the round of lies after he promised not to lie to me.
No question. Dr. David Burt, so with us. Let's move over. You know, this whole Monica Witt deal is just as disgraceful as you could get. Just to bring people up to speed, you have the Justice Department prosecutors yesterday announcing the indictment of a 39-year-old former U.S. Air Force counterintelligence specialist defected to Iran, I think it was 6 years ago, gave classified information to the Iranian government, including the secret mission of a Pentagon program. And prosecutors also accusing this Monica Witt of betraying former colleagues in U.S. intelligence, gave them details about their personal and professional lives to Iran. Information, by the way, used by hackers linked to the Iranian government to target them online. And you know what's crazy here, David? She was warned about her activities by the FBI after she went to an Iranian conference and appeared in one of these, anti-American videos, you see, more than a year before her defection. with agents telling her that she was a potential recruitment target, you know, and that for Iranian intelligence. So it's just unreal how this has unraveled regarding Monica Witt.
Well, one of the greatest fears of the intelligence agencies and defense organizations is the defection of somebody who knows a lot about agency secrets, who can identify human and other assets in the field, and who can turn those assets against us or significantly degrade our capabilities in other ways. And this clearly seems to have happened here. You know, it's interesting what you mentioned about the FBI's having flagged her as a risk beforehand. You know, one of the great balancing acts here is to try to figure out when somebody who comes on the radar screen, for whatever reason, needs to have significant action taken against that individual, deprive them of access, do other kinds of counter-surveillance activities with regard to that individual, or whether it's still a loyal citizen of the United States, an employee of the agency, who needs to be given a little bit of running room and some warning about activity. Clearly, they made the wrong judgment here, but that is another concern. How tight do you tighten the screws, and when do you do that? And that's been a feature of intelligence activity all around the world for a very long time now. And sometimes they get it right. Sometimes, like this one, they get it wrong.
The only question I have in this whole thing, to sum this up, is why the indictment was brought so many years, David Burtzell, after Witt's defection. I can't even fathom an answer to that in a logical sense. We're talking years and years after her defection. I see what officials saying that it really they had to move this classified intelligence into an unclassified format. I can't understand that whole deal.
Well, I have no material knowledge of the case, and I don't know, of course, what the prosecution was thinking in bringing this. But I can imagine that for precisely the things that she is the most serious crimes of which she's being accused, prosecuting her runs the risk of unmasking additional people. So if you're able to say how it is that a person came into possession of knowledge, and there are a few already blown covers that you can point to, well, there may be half a dozen, three dozen additional covers that may be compromised through some of the same channels, and you don't know if they've been compromised. So it could take a long time to track that down. And frankly, after the person is already defected, there's not much chance that you're going to get the person in court anyway. It's more important to protect those assets than to file the indictment.
Interesting. Dr. David Burtzell with us. One more for you, and this is another one here where you have the, you know, the House, Democratic-led it is, with a resolution yesterday they passed that would force the administration now, nobody's really talking about this either, to withdraw troops from Yemen and really moving to assert the power of Congress now over war declarations. You know, they kind of deliver a bit of a rebuke here of the president's alliance. You know, when I caught this yesterday, David, and that with the, you know, the Saudi-led coalition behind the military intervention in Yemen. So that was a kind of an interesting dynamic there with Yemen and the rebuking of the alliance that Trump has with this whole Saudi-led coalition.
There's no question about that. And you've seen earlier in the year parallel action in the Senate to try to suggest the sentiment of that body that they are not on board with the president's war, or the president's alliance, I should say, the Saudis' war in Yemen. And, you know, this is a universally acknowledged human rights crisis. There is broad belief that war crimes are being committed, and we're providing arms and armament to make it all work. It's very, very clear that Mohammed bin Salman, the effective ruler of Saudi Arabia, went so far over every line, not only human rights, not only common decency, but the preservation of his diplomatic range of motion in killing Jamal Khashoggi and then dismembering him in the consulate in Istanbul. So there are major issues here having to do with just pushing too far a United States government that has long stood for the preservation of human rights, where none of that can plausibly be inserted with anything right now having to do with Saudi Arabia or Yemen.
18 Republicans joined the Dems on this whole thing. It's now going to head to the Senate. Who knows what happens there? You know, it's a similar resolution, if I remember correctly, that was passed by senators last year. So I know the White House has threatened that, you know, Trump, I guess, would veto this if it was approved by the Senate. And who knows? You know, this is a fascinating dynamic in all of this, that if it got to the president's desk, this would be the first time Congress has used the War Powers Resolution in the 70s, and that requires congressional approval, by the way, military actions, to stop any type of military intervention. So, you know, that's an interesting one right there, the first time used. That was 1973, folks. But, you know, the White House is now calling this whole thing flawed because, you know, and they make a good point here because, let's face it, U.S. troops have provided support, we know, to the coalition. You know, we know it involved intelligence. They're not involved in the actual fighting against the Iranian-backed rebels. They have provided plenty of support, though, in all.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the first question is this an act of war? Is providing arms, is providing advice an act of war? That's never been tested. It might be tested in this case. Does the Congress have the power of the purse? Unquestionably, it does. That's a plain Article I power of the Congress originating in the House. But when they fund things like the capacity to sell arms abroad, does the Congress have any say in under what terms those arms are distributed, in this case to Saudi Arabia with deployment in Yemen, in ways that we may disapprove of? The administration would argue, and I think this is probably true all the way back to the Reagan administration, that if the Congress tries to intervene in these arenas, it's an unacceptable intrusion on executive branch powers. So there's certain to be, if the administration if there is a bill approved by the Senate, if it winds up on the president's desk, and if he vetoes it, there is certain to be a constitutional Donnybrook over this issue, and a very interesting one with deep consequences for the way that for the balance of power between the legislative and the executive branches.
Listen, as you would think, plenty of concern here, bipartisan too, in Congress. You know, just over this whole humanitarian crisis, and really caused by the Yemen conflict there. So very interesting stuff coming out. We'll see. Lots on the table, my friend. We'll talk soon. Good stuff.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having me.